up finance operations is a challenge that many of us will face in our careers. It can be easy to keep doing things the way that you've always done them, and difficult to know when it's time to make a change and how you're going to find the time to do it. Joining me to discuss this challenge is Andy Young, CFO Central Services at Horwich Farley. Prior to this, he also has almost 20 years in senior finance leadership roles with LV, where he was head of finance, as well as finance systems and change director. He has extensive experience scaling operations, and I'm looking forward to learning more about his experiences today. Thank you so much, Andy, for joining me today.
Hi, thanks, Melissa.
Andy, can you give me a little bit of background about your company and your role with Horwich Farley? Maybe a little bit about your team and some of your responsibilities?
Yeah, so I'm the CFO for Horwich Farley. I've been there for just over 2.5 years now. We started off as a partnership, and in that time, we've converted to a company. We've been a partnership for about 50 years. So conversion to a company had some challenges, financial challenges that we had to deal with. Almost becoming a large company, but building yourself from scratch at the same time. So that had some interesting takes when you're going out trying to source banking arrangements and everything else. Following that, we've gone through quite a lot of growth. We're looking to expand the company. We started around just below 40 million turnover, moved up to 45 as we came to the company, up to 50 million this year, just over, about 52. And we're hopeful for next year to get to 60 million. We're looking to grow it up to 100 million. That's our kind of headline figure as part of our strategy. So there's a lot of growth and challenges with that. Historically, we hadn't had the best investment in IT, so we've put quite a lot of money and resource behind that. So the last few years, we've spent kind of bringing in better finance systems and wider systems throughout the firm so that our solicitors can work more effectively across the piece. And from a finance point of view, we've had to kind of respond to that, respond to a lot of challenges from our professional staff, where all the lawyers need us to service them and make sure the bills are raised, money settled, invoices paid off, and our suppliers kept happy. So it's been quite a challenge to do that. We've had to move some of our resourcing around. The staff have had to be a bit more adaptive to pick up new roles where we've got a system that's doing different things. On top of that, we've introduced planning forecasting. Previously, we didn't really have anything in place. So we moved from kind of a very high 1-year budget, which used to be done within finance and not really any involvement with the business, to actually a 5-year plan, which we've built bottom up with all of the relevant heads of department and partners getting involved in helping us to build that together. And now we're into the stage where, you know, we're monitoring against that on a monthly basis, giving them good reporting and trying to see how they're doing against their budgets, which is quite interesting when they've not been used to it before. So there's been a lot of requirement to kind of expand people's financial knowledge around accounting, which brings some challenges.
It's a really interesting time to be scaling up a company around that 50 million mark as you make your way to 100 million, because it really does require different types of processes, systems, ways of thinking about things and conducting business. So you've had some interesting experience there. And I believe prior to that, your prior company at LV was also experienced that similar high growth. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's right. I mean, at Horwich Farley, we've had to put a lot of effort into the processes. We were, I guess, where we were a partnership before, a lot of things would be manual. So we'd geared up around, if you added more resource at the front end, so the solicitors, we'd add more resource at the back end, so more people to run around and support them and generate bits of paper and move it around the building. As we've gone remote, as part of COVID, and then as part of the expansion, we've had to kind of eliminate the paper and make things more automated. And that's similar to what we did at LV. When I started there, we were probably about 2,000 people. We grew over the 20 years I was there to 6,000 people. Turnover went from below $1 billion to $3 billion. And in that time, you know, it's got its challenges, but a lot of it's around how to automate the processes and take the people out, because it's easy when you're small to get people to do the work. But as you grow, you can't just add more and more people. So it's a case of making sure you put automation in and try and make that as effective as possible. And that brings its own challenges, because some people are happy with the new ways of working and automation. Other people struggle with that. And that's not just the people that are doing it, but the people that kind of get involved from the periphery as well.
You've seen the full gamut. You've seen companies at a variety of different sizes and different challenges, which is really looking forward to digging into some of that experience today. What do you think, when you think today about some of the challenges that CFOs are facing with some of the uncertainty in the economy or in what's happening around them, what are some of those challenges in running the operations and also trying to make sure the company is resilient for whatever may come its way, while also trying to focus on growth?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hard time, because you're trying to grow the top line. You obviously want to grow your profitability, and you're pushed on costs. There's obviously been a lot of wage inflation, and that feeds through to, you know, a higher cost base, which becomes harder. The talent out there is also stretched, I think, across the piece. So there are a lot of firms that are looking to pay more to attract the right talent. And that then becomes a challenge for yourself, because not only have you got high wage inflation, you've also got people that are looking to jump and want higher salaries because of that. I think the whole supply chain is challenged across the piece. So there's just generally higher costs coming through. And that can be, you know, from your day-to-day insurance bills, your power, your gas, your electric, even water. Anything just seems to be more expensive than it was before. And from our point of view, that becomes challenging, because pushing that onto your customers can be quite hard. We're in a position where a lot of our contracts are negotiated over a set period. So actually forcing through some increases to absorb the cost that you're getting becomes harder. So from our side, we've had to look at more efficiencies, making sure we work more effectively, and again, leveraging some of the opportunities from automation to try and maintain that sort of gap of the profit level.
In times like this, and given the variety of experiences that you've had in your career, what do you think are some of the key skill sets that you're having to lean on to lead through times like this?
I guess a lot of it's making sure you bring people along with you. It's around making sure you work as part of the team, that you engage with people. And that's, you know, your peers and the people that work for you and people throughout the wider organization. It takes more time and effort to get involved with people and actually explain why you're doing things. And it probably needs greater involvement than you would have done. When the company's running well and the economy's running well, then everything's a lot easier. You can kind of sit back a bit more and everything kind of works. Whereas I think when you start to get into more of a stress scenario, that's where you have to get more involved, roll your sleeves up, deal with everything that happens, because there are a lot more issues that arise on a daily basis, and that needs to be kind of met and challenged. So I guess from my point of view, it's more being adaptive when you're a CFO. It's not sitting there in your ivory tower and just hoping everything will carry on as it's always done. It's actually getting involved and trying to make a difference, supporting the people that you're working with, and trying to show that you're there for them and you're standing along with them and kind of supporting them in their decisions. And you need to, as there are more challenges on everyone, I think it's also empowering people to get on and make those decisions themselves, to supporting them in that decision-making process and making sure that they feel comfortable that they can make those decisions and they don't need to refer everything upwards.
I agree with you. You know, that need to roll up the sleeves And explaining the why, I think communication becomes so critical that people understand why we have to do things differently or how you've thought about things to come to the conclusion, and then supporting people as well. You know, really, it can be a really unifying time as well if you do it right, but it definitely takes a lot of effort. So you've also played key roles in acquisitions and also integrations of companies. What are some of the skill sets that you've gained there that impact how you lead your team today?
Over the time, it's been quite a few acquisitions that we've been involved in, probably somewhere in the region of 15 to 20 when I was at LB. I think the thing you learn there is you need to dedicate the time and effort and resource to doing the acquisition. It can't be done on the side of a desk. If you try to do that, it just doesn't work. So you need to get the right people in with the right skill set to do that. And often that needs to be the people that, you know, are doing the day job and the ones that you can kind of trust from your current team. So you then get that challenge of how you backfill that role. But I think it's really important to make sure that people involved in the acquisition are pretty much dedicated to it. Yeah, especially on the integration, because it can take up so much time. If you want to integrate properly, you want to take out the costs, you want to take out, you know, the multiple systems that can be in place. That needs people that understand what they're doing, how the company works currently, and how you want to kind of roll the new system into it. I've been lucky where I've worked before, where I've had some good people that have worked with me, and that gives you the opportunity to kind of give them a greater responsibility and take control for these things.
Is there any specific tips or advice that you would have for leaders as they're maybe facing some of this uncertainty, knowing that they need to start scaling their operations and doing things differently? What would be some of your tips you'd give?
One of the main things is don't be afraid to make the change. There's a lot of people that can get quite frightened by it and spend a lot of time debating it or planning it. And sometimes actually it's better to get on with it and start progressing it and then kind of learn as you go, rather than sitting back waiting and then trying to plan for every eventuality. Because I suspect, certainly in my situation, what you normally find is the one issue that comes up is the one that you never planned for, would have planned for. So to a certain extent, I guess people need to be brave. You need to kind of get on and do it. I mean, that isn't to say you shouldn't plan everything. You need to make sure that you've got a plan and that you've thought through the obvious steps, but there'll always be something that's going to catch you out. And actually, you can't just keep planning. Sometimes you just got to get on and do it. And that's the only way to get some of the benefits as well. If you take forever planning it, you'll never actually reach the benefits, or something else will come along and detract you. So the quicker you can get on and do it and execute it, the better, I think.
Yeah, I love that idea of being brave, because I think we're sort of ingrained in us to not take risks and be a little risk intolerant. But there is only so much planning that can be done. And then it's time to, like you said, just get on with it.
And I think that's a challenge for finance people, because you're there for control, you're there for managing risk, et cetera. So I think as a finance person, when you need to be braver, it's not second nature necessarily, because that's not part of your training.
Some of that just comes with some lived experience, I would say.
Yeah.
So let's dig a little deeper into scaling up finance operations. Can you give us an example of a time where you've done that successfully in your career?
What we've probably come across before is this would result as from an acquisition. So what we would have done is dedicated some of our people to deal specifically with that acquisition. And then as you bring that acquisition in, you're bringing those staff back in, and the staff that's kind of covered those people while they've been off doing the acquisition, whether it be the ones that are learning the day-to-day stuff with the other staff that are already there. So you get that benefit when you do an acquisition of kind of training people as though they're replacing existing members of staff who might have left, but actually those existing members of staff have gone to do your kind of important acquisition work and then come back. So at that point, it kind of gives you that benefit and ability to scale. I think the challenge is more where you have that growth that comes, because it's always harder to justify why you're expanding and resourcing up when you're growing, because everyone's sort of like, well, can't you just do it with the same number of people that you had before? And it's often more challenging to kind of justify why you need to spend more resources. The company grows organically than it is for an acquisition. And it often comes in a step change, because, you know, if you increase by 10%, it's very hard to increase one person's role by 10%. You know, you might have two people doing the salary. If you increase the headcount by 10%, you're not going to need another, you know, one person to do payroll, but you can't really add 10% to two people. And I think that's where the challenge comes when you grow organically. It's building those kind of step changes in for the growth, and knowing when to actually execute on additional people for those step changes.
I think you touched on such a difficult responsibility for managers as they lead teams through change as workloads increase. But like you said, we can't just add new resources, it may be perfectly to match with that. Do you have any ideas or thoughts for the audience on how to think about when it is time to add the extra resource, or how you've helped the team to span wider, maybe wearing different hats in the middle zone while you're trying to still get the work done, but knowing there's a growing body of work that needs to happen, or even prioritizing that work?
I guess it's normally, I've probably done it more from prioritization. So it becomes, a bit like triage. What do you do first? What's the most important? And that's where you start to drop some of the work that's less important for now. And as you drop some of that stuff, that's where you get the opportunity to kind of move the work between the people that you have got. And then you can worry about bringing in people to kind of pick up the slack and the need and the bits that you've dropped later on. So for my mind, it's very hard to get resourcing as soon as you need it. And it's particularly hard when, you know, you might need only a fraction of a person and you can't recruit arms and legs. You need to recruit people. So I think it's more around how do you manage the work that you've got and start to drop some of the less important stuff whilst you're managing the recruitment and bringing additional people in so that they can take up the slack of that and where you've had to drop things. And some of that's, like I said, it's around prioritization. So it's more making sure that you can move work around between people. So making sure before you enter some of this that you've got well-trained and people who understood the processes and procedures is really useful. If you're trying to go through growth where you've got a relatively new team and then you're bringing in more new people, that's probably a recipe for disaster. You need to be kind of sure and confident of the people that are there. And that may mean you've got to pay more money. You know, if you have got a raw team, you need to bring in some people with greater experience to start with.
One of the things I found when you're in that period, like what you just described, is that sometimes what that constraint does is it actually helps you identify those lower priority tasks that maybe don't need to come back on the plate because you actually decide you can live without them, or it identifies there were reports maybe you were generating because you've always done them, but people weren't really using them. And so I do think that's one of the other things in terms of scaling that, you know, not being afraid to keep revisiting, what are we doing? Are these the most critical things and what can drop? And maybe it can drop permanently from the workloads as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot of stuff that people do and generate things, particularly from a finance point of view, because someone asked for it once upon a time and then they think it's really important. And we've all seen instances where people are producing the reports, they send it out, you stop it for 2 months and no one even queries it. And then you just don't bother starting it again because no one was really that bothered by it. It probably solved a solution once upon a time and it was needed because of an urgency at that point. But, you know, things move on, the world moves on. The reports people get change as well and they get different information, different ways of accessing it. And it can disappear quite easily. I think the hardest thing though is where people drop things where they think it isn't important and it's not necessarily obvious. that they've dropped it, and then you can find a problem emerges later on. And we've all seen it, you know, a reconciliation gets dropped, someone doesn't do a process, and then 3 months later, you're sitting there going, oh dear, we've got a really big problem now, so we've got to solve it because people thought it could be left when it couldn't be. So it's a real challenge to make sure what's dropped is the right stuff.
When we talk about process improvements and operational efficiency, change management is inevitably a part of the equation. What's your philosophy for how you get people on board and inspired to help get them through the transition?
I think it would depend what you're trying to do is change and who's involved and how near or far they are from that change. Those people that are living and breathing it day in, day out, you need to get involved. And particularly if they're the ones that are having a day-to-day life change as part of it, they're the ones you need to get involved early on. You need to bring into the project, you need to try and get them trained as quickly as possible. And that's not always easy if they're doing a day job as well. You know, getting these people in and showing them a new system or what it's going to be like in the future becomes quite challenging. For those people that are slightly further removed from the process, for them, it's more kind of informative. You need to tell them what's happening, changes come in, make sure there's training for them so that they can be brought along when you go live for it and they've got the training and the expertise when you are going live. And to maybe assist with the testing as well. But I think those people that are going to be doing it day in, day out, they're the ones that, you know, you have to bring in as early as possible, make sure they're involved so that they feel part of that process. So when it actually changes, it's not a big bang to them. It just kind of has happened.
We talked a little bit earlier about adding people or when it's time to add people or you're in that middle zone where maybe it's not quite time and you're not sure. But what are some of the ways you look about figuring out when it is time to add more people or process or technology into the mix to help you scale?
I think it's really hard on people because a lot of the time you're also doing something else around technology or you know, new systems, that type of thing, or changing processes. So because you're doing that, it becomes a lot harder to actually work out whether there is a need to scale up in terms of people as well. It's probably less obvious from that point of view. I think that's quite a challenge. I certainly find it more challenging myself because you get the view as to what you think the new system is going to do and how it's going to change what you do currently. But how that then feeds out to the people and how it then is recognized in real life is always different. So you might think, I'm putting this in, it's going to remove this job totally. And the person that was doing that job can now start to, you know, assist someone else on a different job as we scale up. But what you don't actually realize is there's some other stuff that was going on or it's created an additional piece of work that you didn't expect before. Because I don't know, the interfaces don't work as well, or there's a gap in how things are processed or whatever it is. And I think they're the real challenges around how do you amend and adapt for staff when you're bringing in kind of new system changes. It's kind of the unexpected bits of what you've done, the unintended consequences, I guess. And that's where I think it then becomes a bit more of a, perhaps a firefighting mode where you're going, oh, I didn't expect this. We now need to kind of move some of the resource around to accommodate some of those things that we weren't expecting to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. The change management doesn't end just because you've hired the person or implemented the system. It's an ongoing, you really have to see that through to the end until you know things are actually working.
Yeah. I mean, even today, we put in a change on a system back in September. And it was only today that we actually discovered we've got some rogue items coming through from it. And it was just a flaw in the process. And it was only because someone raised a query due to something else that it's kind of uncovered a gap that we hadn't even realized we had. So, you know, it's easy to happen a year later, probably actually 18 months later. But it's just one of those things, I think. You go in, it's a bit like I said, you can go in, you can prepare and plan for everything. But it's always the things you weren't expecting are going to be the ones that kind of cause you more issues. and you catch a cold later on.
What do you think are some of the mistakes people make when scaling up their finance operations? Either things that we're a little too late to get to, or where we miss the signs, or, you know, some things that you, even if you've got a real life example of things you've learned the hard way that others might be able to avoid.
I guess we've all seen when you go through this as the typical change curve, the hockey stick where it drops before going higher, with engagement in that. And it's just knowing how long that drop's going to happen and how long it's going to last for. You know, I think every system and every change is different. I've been through some where the kind of the period you go through is very short and the drop is very small. And I've gone through others where it feels as though the drop is almost falling off a cliff and it feels as though it's never going to end. And I don't think you can predict either of them, because in my view, they should have both happened in the same way. You kind of tackled them in a similar way with regards to how you trained and went through the process and what you were expecting from the system. But in some cases, it's just how it lands with people, what problems it causes that you weren't expecting. But I think the key for that, as with any change, is how you then react to it. So it becomes kind of, I guess, more a firefighting approach. How do you mobilize the people that you've got to handle it? How do you swing into action? How do you get everyone going in the same direction and making sure that you're solving the real problem that you've got, rather than everyone panicking and not getting on with it?
Yeah, I think as you're saying that, I'm thinking of times where I've experienced that myself. And I think in that moment, it's so important that people realize they're not alone in this pit of despair as things look like they're not working. And oh my goodness, what have we done? Maybe we made a mistake. And having a group, like you said, mobilize around, come together, hey, we're going to figure this out. And what I find is once you get through that and to the other side, there can also be this beautiful time where you look back and you have laughs over some of what you encountered that you never expected. And it can also really be a unifying time for the team once they get through those difficult moments. And I think sometimes those are what help you when you're facing the next project or the next thing that's a challenge that's unexpected, is, you know, remembering, hey, we got through that last time. We know this team has the ability to come together and get through it no matter what.
I think the key for me is making sure you, as a CFO, you're in it with the team. You know, it's not their fault. It's not a blame culture. You need to be there helping and supporting the way you can on this. And I think as the wider business, with anything, it shouldn't be, you know, an excuse to beat someone up or blame them. You know, if something goes wrong, it needs to be everyone behind it trying to solve it. And I think that comes back to the culture of the company a lot of times. You know, you do get people that will try and pass the blame or say it's everyone else's fault. And that's because they have their own challenges and issues. But I think a company that can get behind everyone, support it, and move towards the right answer and, you know, mobilize the company behind solving the problem will be far more effective than a company that sits there and half of them are trying to blame the other half, and the half that are being blamed just feel, you know, as though the whole world's beating them up. So I think it's really important, you know, when you go through change, to get everyone behind it and on the same side.
Absolutely. So some great advice there. What advice would you give to finance leaders on how to make impact in the year ahead, especially as they're thinking about scaling their business?
I suspect a lot of this comes back to, you know, finance being a business partner with the rest of the organization. As they're growing, you need to be there with them to support them through that, give them the information so they know what's going on, so they know they're making the right decisions. And that's really critical, because people don't know they're making the right financial decisions at the end of the day. They're making these decisions based on gut feel and what they think is going to happen. So providing that critical information as promptly as possible is really important. And that can be really hard. And it needs a specialist skill as well, I think. And it can be quite hard to get that skill. But getting out there, engaging with the various areas and being involved with them is critical as they're making these decisions so that they make the right ones and it's informed. And ultimately, you can kind of report on it and know that you're doing the right thing.
We certainly can add some safety to the decision. And I think one of the other things, too, that you just made me think of there was we often see data and insights that we can assume that others see what we see, but maybe they don't. And by sharing that other piece of information, it can help give people a more well-rounded picture of what they're doing to be more confident with the decisions they're making.
I'd agree with that. And I think the other thing to remember is not everyone is, you know, financially literate when it comes to it. So sometimes you have to break it down into kind of more simple terms, I guess, when you're explaining some of this. And that can be quite hard, you know, for finance people, you're used to talking your own language, as it were. And it depends on the company. You know, when I worked at LV, because it's an insurance company, it's very heavily on finance. So a lot of people there are really embedded into how the finances work in that. Working now in a law firm, you find it's less so because it's not by nature what they do on a daily basis. So it becomes harder. And I think it does need kind of more support and explanation, perhaps, than it does in others. So it's kind of knowing your target market and then making sure that you kind of explain it so that they can understand what's going on.
I'm thinking of some of those aha moments I've had along the way in my career where I've told somebody something, but then later on, they didn't know that piece of information. And it makes me realize, hey, I might have shared it with you or told you, but if you actually didn't really realize what I was saying, something about the way I was communicating it means it didn't land. And so you're right. We really do have to tailor our communication for the audience and also make it simple. Because if we've over-explained it or made it too complex that people just glazed over, they didn't hear what we said, right? They need it to be communicated in a way that's actionable and memorable for them. So, and that's a skill we've always got to keep on working on.
I'd agree. I think it's interesting. I can remember many years ago, someone told me about different methods of training. It's one that's always stuck with me. You can, some people will learn by doing, some by reading the instruction manual, some by watching others. You know, they're all different ways of doing it. But people won't learn by the wrong method. So you have to adapt the method to get them to learn. And that's the same with explaining things. You know, people will understand it in different ways. You need to be able to explain it in different ways to people so they can kind of understand that. And it's not always easy because logically you always think, I'll explain it in the way that I'd want someone to explain it to me.
Well, thank you so much. Such great advice you've shared with us today. Now, whenever we have a guest on the show, we do have two rapid-fire questions that we like to ask. Are you ready?
Go on, then.
What is the best piece of business or leadership advice that you've ever received?
So, at one stage, when I was at LV, I moved into a new role, and I was meant to have a team of, I think it was 6 or 7 people, and I only had 2 in place at the time. And I was delivering a lot of group information and there was a lot happening all at once. And I was struggling to do everything. And I was kind of working evenings, weekends, just doing more and more. And I can remember my boss at the time, where I'd missed something, turned around to me and said, well, why have you missed it? And I said, look, I'm killing myself here. I'm doing weekends, evenings. I'm working almost 24/7 to do it. And he said to me, Andy, what you've got to remember is triage. It's the same as in first aid. What you've got to do is the most important thing and then move to the second most important thing and treat it that way. And anything that's less important, don't do. You know, people will shout and scream if it's important. If it's not, it would just disappear. He said, don't try and do everything, just triage it. And I guess that's one thing that's always stuck with me. You know, do what you can in the day, but triage it rather than try and do everything, because you're never going to be able to do everything that everyone wants you to do. So I think that was probably one of the most kind of impactful bits of information I've ever had from anyone when I've been at work.
Yeah, it makes you think of an emergency room, right? So that's one that I can see how that would stick in your head for a long, long time.
when you relate it back to that, it's quite easy. And that's what people are taught, as you say, in an emergency room or a paramedic when they're out, at a crash site or something like that. You have to treat it in a priority. And some people aren't life or death, you know. It might be bleeding, but it's not as important as someone who can't breathe. So it's making sure that you think of it in that sense, I guess.
And the next question, what book has had the most impact on you?
The book that's had the most impact on me is one that's called A Manual of Modern Rope Techniques. And that's because I'm a climber. And in that book, I learned a lot of different ways of self-rescue and rescuing others when you're on a climb. And I have had to put it into action a couple of times before. So where I've had someone who I can bring up from a climb, where they got stuck and, you know, you need to get them out of that situation. Actually knowing how to do kind of rescues and that from rope techniques is really useful. And that's one of the books that kind of gave me that insight to do that.
Well, I think that for the audience, if they're looking for a climbing partner, you would now be in my top list of people to go climbing with, knowing that you've read that book. So it's definitely a high impact book. Well, thank you, Andy, so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. It's been great.
And to the audience, thank you for listening and watching. If you'd like to learn more about today's show, please visit the links in the show notes. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to and watch your podcasts, because you don't want to miss an episode. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on any of the streaming platforms. We always like to hear from you, and it helps other listeners find the show. For the CFO Show, I'm your host, Melissa Howitson. Until next time.